Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires that we call the internets is Joe, Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
I am not going to talk to you until you stop screaming.
I haven't even started screaming.
Ugh. Folks,
did you went out and get drunk last night?
For those of you who love it when we break kayfabe, this will probably be one of the fastest turnarounds Corey will ever do, because we are recording this Sunday morning, and I don't know if Corey's going to pull a miracle and get it up Sunday night.
Of course I will.
But the reason why is because the day we were going to record, I thought I'd go out and, you know, I had forgot what it was like to, you know, have a little food poisoning and woof my cosmic cookies in a face, a place not built for my face, you know, so. But, you know, it's not all my fault, because then Corey had to go to Tim Hortons with Sharon instead of recording Friday, and then he had to do his bad movie night instead of recording on Saturday. Of course, I mean, had nothing to do with that. I was at work till midnight. But, you know, we're going to shift the blame here to Corey. Somehow.
It's always my fault.
It is. But you're not to blame.
No, I'm always to blame. Let's remember that. That was taught to us in the past. I am always to blame.
But then it's not your fault, because it can't be both. It's one or the other. You're just being greedy again. What have I told you about that?
That I should quit cleaning people's apartments?
No, actually, that I approve of. Because, you know,
you're the only one!
Well, so do all the women that don't necessarily care to have you as a friend. Like, come on, Strode, clean my place!
Clean my place and then never speak to me again.
What made this week so unique is that we had some really hot news that kind of swept over the comic industry. Although other news has since replaced it, we're going to go back and just cover, and we're talking, of course, of Bendis, that's Brian Michael to you, leaving Marvel and going to work for DC, which is pretty freaking amazing, because, I mean, Bendis has pretty much been Marvel's mainstay. Oh, great googly moogly.
Since about 2001, when he started on Ultimate Spider-Man.
Yeah, oh, Ultimate Spider-Man.
And then 2004, when he took over the Avengers.
Yeah, yeah. And if you look at it, and I've been reading his stuff, as you know, and that's actually in one of my geekings, because I'm reading the soft covers that they're doing with all of his work. It actually flows as like one continuous story through the different special events. And up until he ends it, and then, of course, Hickman took over with his crazy run. Bendis went to X-Men. And that's about the only time I saw when, and I think, Corey, you might agree, where we kind of, the roles started to kind of fall off. Because while what he did in the X-Men was pretty cool, it didn't seem like it had an ending. In Avengers, it seemed like his stuff came to a natural ending. It's like, okay, Bendis is done. Time for Hickman to take over. But in X-Men, it was just kind of over. Didn't really end up with anything. You know, I wonder if somebody changed the idea. You know, like maybe he thought, okay, we're going to bring the X-Men, put them back in time. Or maybe somebody said, you know what, this X-Men, the young X-Men in the current time is actually pretty good. Let's leave them here and let somebody else do it.
Well, in the past, one of the things that he did on his run in Daredevil, he ended it by having Matt Murdock in jail. And he talked to the next writer and said, hey, I'm thinking of doing this and letting you play with it after that. And it worked, because Ed Brubaker had an excellent run on Daredevil. He picked up right from where Bendis left off and played with Daredevil in jail, and then moved forward from that. And it could be the same thing where the next writers they went to and said, hey, we're thinking of keeping them here. Are you okay with that?
I'm sure he was, because he's like, yeah, my run's over. What you want to do with it is...
Yeah, the X-Men conclusion, I felt, and I agree with you that it didn't quite work, was the Beast going on trial. And the Beast kind of being the character that is going to pay the price for what he did. But I wanted to go back a little further. I wanted to talk about what Bendis did for Marvel when he came on. Because Bendis is one of these guys, I think it was like 8-9 years ago, they took a picture of all the main writers that were working at Marvel, and they called them the architects. And they are all gone, except for Bendis, who's now left.
And I got to tell you, Bendis... it's in that category of writers where if he decided to write the phone book, I would follow.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a big Iron Man fan, but he's doing his current run, and I'm sure it'll wind up. Whatever he goes with, I'm kind of like, yeah, I'm around with it, because eventually it'll be interesting to see where the payoff comes. And in Avengers, it was really good. I kind of dropped out of the Ultimate Universe after a while. Although I came back occasionally.
Well, I can point to where I quit caring about the Ultimate Universe, except for Ultimate Spider-Man, and that was Ultimatum.
Yeah. See, I didn't mind the book, but it was one of those, you know, we're going to tip over the sandbox and just because we can. You know, and I was kind of like, yeah, I could see this happening. They're never going to get that extreme in the regular Marvel Universe.
But then they had nothing, no follow-up for it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they never really did follow. Well, what happened to Doctor Strange? Eh, nothing. And then with Secret Wars, they kind of folded it all over. But, yeah, we keep jumping back and forth in the story.
Well, when Bendis came on, the way he came to Marvel, he had worked on his own stuff with Goldfish, Jinx, and then he got hired by Todd McFarlane to do Sam and Twitch. And he brought a very different storytelling style to Sam and Twitch. And when Joe Quesada came into Marvel, he was looking to shake things up like he had done with the Marvel Knights books. And one of the things that they told him was, we want trade paperbacks. When the X-Men movie came out, we did not have merch to sell. We didn't have trade paperbacks. We want trade paperbacks for when we have media projects. DC is kicking our ass when it comes to the backlist and in bookstores. And a lot of people forget that when Quesada was brought in, he was told, that's what we want.
Which was actually kind of ironic, because at the time, Marvel was really bad at letting shit go out of print. You know, it'd be like, if a retailer got ready to order something, it'd be like, okay, I can order X-Men Volume 1, Volume 4, and Volume 6, but everything else is out of print, with no hope of ever getting it back in print.
But one of the big things was, they went to the current X-Men books, and there was no way to put out a trade paperback of any of the stuff that was being done. None. Because the big crossover stories were, you know, 20 comics connected. And a trade paperback is usually between 6 and 12.
And again, this is before they came up with the idea of what they're doing now.
Yeah, it was before the Epic line, before the omnibuses. They wanted stuff with a $10 to $20 price point that they could get into bookstores. When the X-Men movie came out, and they didn't have it. They didn't have it because the X-Men had been an ongoing soap opera for so long, no one used the word the end. Same with the Avengers, same with all the books. Everybody was using this Chris Claremontian style, because the X-Men sold well, so Bob Harris told everybody, write it like the X-Men. Don't ever let a story end. And Bendis came in. He was hired to do Ultimate Spider-Man. He co-wrote the first story with Bill Gemmis, who was the publisher at the time. And they took Spider-Man's origin, turned it into a 6 or 7 part story. And a lot of people, before the Ultimate Universe came out, Joe, did you have the shop when the Ultimate Universe started?
No.
Okay. So
no, I had the shop 2004, 2006.
No, I mean the first shop.
I don't think so.
Before the Ultimate Universe came out, people didn't expect a lot of it, and it sold really well. It sold surprisingly well. And the Ultimate Spider-Man sold better than the regular Spider-Man book for a while. The Ultimate X-Men did not sell as well as the X-Men, but it sold, again, really, really well. But the trade paperbacks, when they came out, blew the doors off. I remember when the Spider-Man movie came out. If you went the first weekend to the movie theater, they had a special reprint of Ultimate Spider-Man number 1 that you'd get. And that was kind of a big deal, because in the back it was, and here are all these trade paperbacks of Spider-Man. You could go to the bookstore or your local comic shop. Here's a phone number for comic shops. And here's, you know, you could buy all these books. And because Bendis did so well on that, he also was hired to do Daredevil after Kevin Smith. And he had a completely different storytelling style than Marvel. It's a storytelling style that people are used to now, but if you were around back then, comics were very much plotted the Marvel method, which was the writer would give the artist the plot. Sometimes it would be detailed, sometimes it would just be 2 pages of here's what the story is, and the artist would go off and draw it, and then they'd bring it back, and the artist would script over the finished artwork. And when Stan did it, part of it was because Stan was writing everything and didn't have time to write full scripts, and part of it because the artists he hired were so good at stories that he could just tell them the story. Gene Colan talked a lot about how he'd come into the office. Stan wouldn't even write it down. He'd just act out the story in the office. Joe, you know the story where Dr. Doom steals the Silver Surfer's powers, right?
Yeah.
3-part story? The plot that he gave Kirby was, Dr. Doom steals the Silver Surfer's surfboard. That was the plot. So if you go back, Joe talked about recently reading Maximum, what was that, Maximum something.
Oh, the prison one?
Yeah. I've gone back and read it, and it's just big blocks of script over the art. I love Kurt Busiek. I enjoy his writing, but just blocks and blocks of text. Bendis, who is also an artist, pared all that down. He let the art tell the story. He didn't have the captions explaining what was happening in the panels. His dialogue was more movie-based than comic book-based. So when two guys are fighting, they're not also having a big discussion. They're fighting. When it's dialogue, it's written like thematic dialogue rather than, I, Captain America, have been, you know, thought out from blah, 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 and I want to know, Falcon, why you think this is happening. Well, Cap, as your partner for the last 7 years, Bendis just kind of went, hey, Falcon, what's happening? And the dialogue would be a lot more condensed. Because the art told the story stretched out longer. And at the time it was called decompression. And I still remember at the convention talking to some of the older writers who just hated it. They hated it. because they would say, ah, they take a story that would be one issue and stretch it out to six. Artists, however, enjoyed it a lot more because they were the ones telling the story. And it really changed how comic book stories were told. It's why when you go back and you read something from 99, it feels so much older than something from 2004. Joe, when Bendis came on the scene at Marvel, he, you know, first did Daredevil and Ultimate Spider-Man. What was your impression? Because it was a different style. All right, Joe, when Bendis came on at Marvel, it was a different style, you know, on Daredevil and Ultimate Spider-Man. What was your impression when you first started reading his style?
Well, I didn't read the Daredevil run, and it, to me it didn't really affect sales. Ultimate Spider-Man, though, caught everybody's attention. Then again, New Universe caught everybody's attention, too. But and I think it was a fresh take on Spider-Man because he was a kid. The art was great with Mark Bagley. And like you said, the graphic novels just sold like crazy. You just kept them in stock. They just became perennials. So it was a kind of a combination of the two. And certainly, when they tried to expand the Ultimate Universe, they sold as well, but not as continually. You know, whereas people either hated or loved Miller's Ultimate Avengers, the Spider-Man one kept going pretty well.
And were you a fan?
I was. Although I picked up most of the Ultimates in trades, mostly because at the time that Ultimate One went so bug-nut crazy that I figured, you know what, I'll just sell mine and just pick it up with the trades. And it was more fun to read as a trade because you were getting a full story. But again, that was right on the cusp of me selling the shop. And, you know, we already had a pretty good graphic novel presence to begin with. So as far as changing to the, you know, okay, we're writing for the graphic novel idea, that really didn't affect graphic novel sales per se, although it was certainly easier to sell, say, like a Star Wars run because it was a complete story, you know, a bunch of miniseries rather than, you know, an ongoing mishmash or whatever.
And then because kind of Bendis proved his worth, he was given the Avengers, and he did Avengers Disassembled.
Which, again, you either loved or hated.
Oh, online people lost their minds. But it sold through the roof. Because Avengers hadn't sold since Perez had left. And they'd tried everything.
Well, yeah, I tried reading that run after Busiek left. Oh, it wasn't good.
That's Jeff Johns. You know, Jeff Johns, who resurrected DC. Jeff Johns, who, you know, now is running their movie.
And bringing back Watchmen.
Yeah. Doing a sequel to Watchmen. And once he took over the Avengers, Joe talked about how he had this long story arc where stuff was planned long out in advance. But in a way, he changed the idea. He actually went back. In my opinion, he went back to the original idea of the Avengers, which was, these are Earth's mightiest heroes. And sales-wise, you take the most popular characters. If you go back to the original Avengers, it was, hey, here's all our solo heroes, except for Spider-Man, because Kirby doesn't quite get Spider-Man. And the Fantastic Four, because they're already a team. But here's everybody else. He also brought back the big event comics with House of M. Because Marvel quit doing the big crossover event comics for a while. And House of M was kind of the first time they brought that back. And it's also, they brought back the miniseries that spun out of it. And the reaction to House of M, I remember at the time, people were pissy about that too.
Which is really too bad, because it sold really well.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. People would be pissy about Bendis, but the stuff would sell. His Avengers, I still, people were, I hate his storytelling, and I hate this, and he doesn't care about continuity, and he doesn't care about the past. Well, then why is it the number one book?
Yeah, he turned Avengers, it outsold X-Men.
And he stayed on the Ultimate Universe. He's still writing. You know, Ultimate Spider-Man, even though now it's in the Marvel Universe, he's done 230-some issues of it. And they actually made it a big deal when he and Mark Bagley passed Stan and Jack's run on the Fantastic Four. And they did, like, what, 150 issues together before Bagley went to DC?
Yeah.
So, in a lot of ways, Bendis changed how comics were told. He was also part of the writer's room. You know, they would get together every 6 months and go, and they would plan out the next 3-4 years of Marvel. And then 6 months later, they'd go, okay, what's working? What's not? All right. Do we need to change the plan? What are we going to do after that? And one of the things I think that people don't tend to get because they don't think that way is Bendis is a guy, he won't do anything until he answers the question, well, then what? Yeah, we're going to, no more mutants. Well, then what? Oh, okay, well, we're going to get back to this, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this. And okay, we're going to have time get broken by Ultron. All right, then what? And a lot of writers, especially in comics, will just do the big thing. There will be huge changes. Then what? I don't know. But I think when his Avengers run ended, when he went over to the X-Men, it did not do... He didn't make the X-Men the number one selling comic. And he has... Not everything he's done has been a huge, rousing success. I'm looking at you, Spider-Woman.
Well, he did make Guardians of the Galaxy an interesting book.
But it did not sell that well when he did it, which is weird. And, well, the other thing is that he did the first adult Marvel comic with Alias. And do you remember the outcry before it came out, Joe?
I don't.
Marvel's doing an adult comic line, and a lot of older creators and fans were furious about it. The guy who campaigned against it, I'm going to name names because I remember, is now a guy who's given the Alias book great reviews. Tony Isabella.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Isabella said that Marvel should not be doing adult-themed comics. The comics should still be aimed at the general market. That starting an adult comic line is death. First issue of Alias came out. He panned it. Hated it. But by the time they did the first trade paperback, he was recommending it. And in a lot of ways, he's created some of the characters. You know, there's a lot of talk about how he didn't create any characters for Marvel that, you know, lasted. Jessica Jones had her own TV series. No one gave a shit about Luke Cage till he used him. He brought back a lot of characters that had fallen by the wayside. He made them more interesting. And what he used to say all the time was he knew that his time as the guy was limited. And he talked about how, you know, in the 70s, Roy Thomas was the guy. And eventually he started to fade. And then Marv Wolfman was the guy. And eventually he started to fade. And he knew that that would happen to him too. But he, really, a 17-year run at Marvel... There aren't a lot of people who can say that they had a 17-year run as Marvel's kind of lead guy. And until 4 or 5 years ago, Bendis was also involved in the movies. He's the guy who wrote the post-credit scenes in Iron Man. So I thought before we get into what he will do over at DC, we talk a little about what our favorite Bendis books were. Joe?
Oh, for me, it was Avengers. I mean, I loved Kurt Busiek's Avengers, and it was one of the first Marvel books I read, starting way back with 200. You know, we always talk about Jim Shooter had that run. And for me, it was during my golden age where I was just enthralled with it. And eventually, I think I bought Avengers mostly out of habit. You know, there were a lot of good things, but it wasn't like such a fantastic book, especially not when you were comparing it to X-Men and all of, you know, back then there was only a couple X-Men books. Now there's a whole library of it. And so when he took it over, I mean, it was just amazing. I could not wait for the next issue of, you know, definitely New Avengers. I didn't really go for Mighty Avengers. I kind of backed out when Dark Avengers hit, but then I realized it was all part of an arc. Although I wonder, maybe you could tell me, Corey, did sales on Dark Avengers actually do that well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so again, it was just me. So, I mean, eventually it folds back into the main story. And I tell you, I'm having a fun time reading these huge Bendis Avenger books because a lot of it's covering runs that I either didn't read, and also rereading some of it, which I just totally forgot about, you know, because you remember the high points of the story, but you always forget the minutia details. It's always fun to reread it. Alias, of course, was a fun one. I picked it up as graphic novels because that first issue just went crazy, and I probably just sold my run on the eBays, and eventually I just bought the omnibus, which I believe my daughter Holly is still reading. I enjoyed X-Men when he ran the X-Men. I was excited. Again, it didn't quite wow me the way the Avengers did. I enjoyed his run on Guardians. And I'm enjoying his run on Iron Man, although, like, we talked about when he brought Ironheart in, the young girl that took over the Iron Man. She wasn't for me. I stuck with Infamous Iron Man to see what Doom was up to, and now the story arcs have converged again, kind of in a search for Tony. I just hope the storyline will be finished before Bendis departs. Did not pick up his Defender run, although I probably will pick up the graphic novel, the inevitable graphic novel, as things are now.
His run on Ultimate Spider-Man is one of my favorite comic runs of all time. He and Mark Bagley did a phenomenal job without rehashing the early issues of Spider-Man, which when a lot of people do a kind of a revamp, they want to rehash. He went off in different directions. You know, Mary Jane knew that he was Spider-Man real early on. He dealt with topics like would Mary Jane and Peter Parker sleep together because they're teenagers. And they went through and had a discussion about that. He reimagined the villains. He even made the Clone War interesting. And then the introduction of Miles Morales. The death of Peter Parker really didn't hit me as hard. I don't think that story was as emotionally resonant as it should have been. But the introduction of Miles Morales and the whole run of Miles Morales I've enjoyed. Alias. I think Alias is one of the best comics Marvel put out in the last 20 years. There is a series that was a continuation of that in the Marvel Universe called The Pulse, which was Jessica Jones working at the Daily Bugle. And I hope they do a new series, a new reprint on that. His Ultimate Marvel Team-Up. probably one of the coolest runs of comics in the 2000s, because what it was, he did kind of Marvel team up, but every issue was by a different indie artist, including people like Matt Wagner. Ted McKeever. It also had characters in the Ultimate Universe before they'd been introduced, so in a lot of ways it was a lot of the first introduction of that character in the Ultimate Universe. Joe talked about his Avengers run. I loved Dark Avengers. I loved the whole idea of Dark Reign, where the villains took over the Marvel Universe, and it wasn't just, you know, one-shots. It was complete stories. I adored that stuff. I loved his run on the X-Men. I liked bringing back the original five into the current Marvel Universe. And his Daredevil run is a highlight for me. His Daredevil run, in many ways, kind of went back to the Frank Miller run, but it also was a new version of that, so it was more that style of storytelling, and you could see his love of crime stories in that, especially the whole thing where Daredevil's secret identity gets out. And if you look at that, in a lot of ways, that was when Marvel kind of got rid of the whole secret identity thing for the majority of their characters. The majority of their characters no longer have secret identities. And the ones who do, it makes it that much more special because it's not something every character has. I don't think everything he did was a success, but I'm looking at you, Civil War II. But I think that overall, his run on Marvel was one of the better writer runs in a long time. And, you know, we talk about his influence. He just changed how comics were done. He brought back full scripting. Before him, if you worked at Marvel, you did Marvel Method. And when he came in, he gave full scripts. And now the majority of people who work at Marvel write full scripts. Which I think actually helps, myself. Because how many times have you read a comic where it's really clear the artist went off and drew something that they wanted to draw, and the writer's having to change the story in the captions because it's, God damn it, I told you we needed to get here.
Meanwhile.
I can't even think of a good example. But there were so many in the 90s where you'd read it, and it's like, that's not what's going on in the art. What would you like Bendis to do when he jumps to DC?
Everything. Slave that sucker to a typewriter and just keep him cranking. Now, this is interesting because I've pretty much come to the conclusion DC has left me behind because as much as I'm enjoying the graphic novels that they're republishing of the stuff pre-52, what strikes me sad is that a lot of that's irrelevant because it has nothing to do with the new 52. And sorry, DC, that's just a sticking point for me because, you know, all these great stories that I've enjoyed just ain't relevant. Yeah, I can go back and read them over and over, but I have a hard time caring about the new spin on the characters. Although I do see, you know, you're kind of slowly, you're not shifting back to the way they were, but you're kind of moving to your counterpart in the movies. It also comes a conclusion where, you know, DC, I don't need 15 Batman books. It's confusing. Every time I open up a Batman and the Batman's in there, I mean, there's got to be a clone of Batman. Because he is just in every frickin' DC book I turn around. I don't need 27 Superman books. I don't need 27 Wonder Woman books. In some way, they're taking the lessons that Marvel did and they're misapplying them. And just like, oh yeah, well if one Batman book's good, let's do 27. I'm not saying it's, you know, don't use the supporting characters. You know, if you want to do a Dick Grayson book or a Nightwing book or Red Robin book, fine. But I look at so much of DC, and I just don't care. That said, I'm going to be very interested in what Bendis does. I would love to see him get a hold of Justice League and make it the Justice League. You know, right now you've got Justice League of America, which is everybody but the Justice League, which is like the clique of the big six or five or however many they have. Put the books back together. Really, I don't know if we need 27 Justice League books. Just one good one. And if Bendis does his magic on it, then you can branch off into a second one. Hence, New Avengers. It was just one book and eventually moved into other books. I'd like to see him maybe take some of the more obscure characters and see what he could do with them. It's really weird because DC's got so many characters. But the question is, do they work? You know, is it Chimpanzee Detective or Detective Chimp or whatever?
Detective Chimp.
Does that even work?
Well, it did in the Bill Willingham book. What was that?
How about Space Cabbie? Is that something that's really relevant? I mean, you look at all these old characters, and yeah, every so often they make a guest appearance, and it's kind of a nostalgia twinge, but is that something you could make a series on? Let Bendis sift through this toy box and see what he comes up with. I told you already, I mean, Bendis could write the phone book and I'd pick it up. I'm real curious to see what he picks up, and I'm sure it'll be kind of a love-hate thing where, I never did read Bendis's Daredevil run. It's something I get to look forward to.
Yes, it is.
And so I'm sure whatever he gets, you know, there'll be things that I like it, or not for me, I'll bow out. Or I'll just wait for the graphic novels. So, you know, chain them to a desk, hook them up with feeding tubes, and just type. Just type.
Well, he has always done like minimum three or four books a month. I think right now at Marvel he's doing 1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, Iron Man went from 2 to 1, so they set that back with the Legacy.
Yeah, but there's Defenders.
Jessica Jones.
Jessica Jones.
Iron Man.
Yep. And one of the things I find interesting is no one has said anything about his creator-owned books, which are at Marvel, but then again, he hasn't put out a new issue of any of those for a year.
Yeah, although I did see a tweet saying that he would still be working on those at Icon.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. when I get a chance.
Brilliant. Yeah, that had two issues. Scarlet. Took him 3 years to finish the first story, to finish the second story arc. United, the Mob book. He did the first story arc and then nothing. Powers. When's the last time we saw an issue of Powers? And the thing is, I enjoy his creator-owned books a lot, but they don't come out. I would like to see him take over Superman. Because I like when Bendis does a solo character. His run on Daredevil. His run on Ultimate Spider-Man. His run on Iron Man. I like it when he does a solo character. His team books are really good if he's part of, you know, the big picture. You know, everybody's going to say, oh, he should take over the Justice League, he should take over the Justice League. When he came to Marvel, the Avengers was kind of the second or third league team, so I think at DC he should take over a book that used to be big, New Teen Titans. And I wonder if he's going to be working with Geoff Johns, who's kind of the only architect right now, because I have not heard that DC has a writer's room. So, do you think Bendis is going to become one of the architects at DC?
God knows they need it, because I don't see their books as a coherent universe. I see them as a bunch of individual, tiny universes, you know, spinning their wheels trying to catch someone's attention. I don't know how sales are on DC, but, boy, they could use a little sharpening. You know, and I'm not talking, it's like you got your, you know, they do their event books and a few of them tie in, but I just don't get the feeling that DC is like a cohesive universe anymore.
And this current event that they're in the middle of, that's a huge, big seller, you know, the DC Metal, it just feels like another big Batman story to me. It doesn't feel like the whole universe is involved.
And I'm enjoying it. I mean, you heard me on podcasts past, you know, I pick up the issue when, you know, I heard Daniel from Sandman was in it, and I'm like, you know, I'm actually enjoying this because Batman's not like a I can do it myself asshole. He's like, I got to find out what this is, but I'm going to need your guys' help when I figure it out. And he figured it out. And of course, if the only thing that comes out of it is like new characters, I'll be a little disappointed, but I'll enjoy the run while it lasts.
By the way, they've delayed everything.
I noticed that. I was looking at my previews, and I was like, okay, there should be a number 5 here, I think. Maybe not. Now, the other thing, too, is we've talked about what this means for DC and what we're looking for. What does this mean for Marvel?
I think in a perfect world at Marvel, it means that some of the newer people are going to have to step up and take his place.
This might be part of what, you know, everybody's talking about what they need to do to get Marvel going. And Marvel came up with legacy books, which I think isn't the problem. But, you know, if it makes somebody warm and fuzzy that they now have an Iron Man 652, fine, so be it.
I think it's more the warm and fuzzy of bringing back the original characters because the rumor is one of the reasons that Bendis started to talk to DC about jumping was when at the last Writers Summit, when one of the publisher, the guy above the editor-in-chief, said this diversity thing isn't working. And started, you know, basically just ripping the fact that they'd replaced all these characters with characters that were, you know, women or minorities or things like that. And he singled out the stuff that Bendis had been doing as not working. And Bendis did not take that well. There was also the fact that Bendis used to be involved in working in the movies and the TV shows. Well, he's not involved in the new Spider-Man cartoon. He's not involved in the movies anymore. None of the comic people are involved in the movies. But Dan Slott's the guy who's doing the Spider-Man cartoon. And other people are the ones doing the Avengers and Guardians of the Galaxy cartoons. So they kind of cut him out of that. And I've been in places where you're doing stuff and then you're no longer doing it and it feels like a demotion. He went over and started talking, hey, DC, what are you willing to offer me? That's the rumor.
And you know us, we're good for a good rumor.
Oh, yeah. Especially one that kind of sounds right. Because the legacy thing, they are, okay, Captain America's going to be back to who he was. We're not going to call the Falcons Captain America anymore. He's the Falcon. And Tony Stark's going to be back as Iron Man. And this character's coming back. And this character's coming back. And this character's coming back.
I don't know if that's going to make a difference. But if it gives Marvel a warm fuzzy, so be it.
Yeah. Well, they got to do something.
Oh, good stories would be helpful.
Yeah, that'd help. But I think one of the guys who could really step up and take some of what Bendis did for universe building would be Jason Aaron, who's doing a phenomenal job on Thor, and who's really built that character out a lot to where there's a lot more there than there used to be. And he did the same thing with Doctor Strange when he came on to Doctor Strange. He expanded the Doctor Strange, what Doctor Strange meant in the universe, and he created a whole bunch of new toys for Marvel. What I wanted to ask about, Joe, there have been other people who've jumped to DC or Marvel, and I wanted to ask you, I'm going to throw a few names out there, and you let me know if they're jumping was a success or not. So are you ready?
Sure.
Let's go with the first big jump, and that was Jack Kirby jump into DC. Do you think that was a success?
Nope. It was a success in that it gave them Darkseid to play with, but I don't see it being a success. You know, you're either into the fourth world or you're not. And I've heard plenty of people just say, you know what, whatever Kirby was trying to do just was too trippy. I've also people say it's the most brilliant thing they've ever seen. I can't deny, you know, it really, you know, again, Kirby gave them some tools to play with, you know, and they've been making hay on it ever since. I hope the Kirby estate's certainly getting paid for it. But as far as him going there and jumping back to Marvel, I don't think it was the incredible coup that everybody thought it would, especially since they ended up canceling most of his books anyways.
I would agree that the sales didn't do that well. He did give them a whole bunch of stuff that they're still mining today.
Oh, hell yeah.
DC's best book right now is Mr. Miracle, by far. But sales-wise, they didn't do that well that we know of, because DC had no patience back then. No patience back then. And that was back when you would build up over time. You know, at Marvel, it took, Spider-Man was their number three or four seller for years until basically a decade later it became their number one seller. And how much of that was the cartoon? It was the only Marvel cartoon that was competently made in the 60s. I think creatively it was a success, but sales-wise and for Kirby's satisfaction, it wasn't a success. Here's the next jump. Joe? Len Wein.
I got to tell you I'm ignorant of it. I don't know a lot about it. It was before my time, and if it happened while I was reading comics, it wasn't something that I noticed.
For me, I think that was a huge success, not for Len's writing, but for the editing. If you look over the books he edited in the 80s, New Teen Titans, Blue Devil, Crisis on Infinite Earths, as a writer, his stuff was okay. You know, his short Batman run was okay. His Green Lantern run was good. But he's the guy who brought Alan Moore over. He's the guy who did Crisis on Infinite Earths, DC's Who's Who, all of that stuff. In that way, it was a success.
Yeah, see, and while I'll agree with you now because I'm aware of what he did, I was pretty ignorant of creators back then.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I read all those comics. I enjoyed the hell out of them. But to me, it was just like I was not aware of what was going on behind the scenes. So in that context, I would have to agree with you.
Roy Thomas.
That was a huge jump
at the time.
It was. Again, I was just too ignorant of creators at the time to know if it was a big thing or not.
I don't think he ever had a big sales success. They put him on Wonder Woman to revamp that, and that didn't work. All-Star Squadron was a great, fun comic, but it never sold that well.
Until they killed it with Crisis.
Yeah, but the last year it just kind of limped along by doing Secret Origins.
Yeah, and that was because, like I said, they killed it with Crisis. Because they took away Wonder Woman, Superman, and really kind of limited what Roy was trying to do, you know, telling us decent stories in the DC Golden Age. I always laugh about when he, they're talking to Superman. So, what are you doing? Oh, I fought this guy named Luthor. And, go see Superman number 4 to see what he was. Yeah, I'll go take a copy.
I'll just pop that in.
Yeah, we'll just read it.
Arrak, Son of Thunder, was supposed to be his Conan for DC. It lasted 50 issues. Didn't sell.
Yeah, I remember reading that, because here's a big one coming from a creator. I don't know.
Yeah. I liked his stuff at DC, but you can't point to any of it as huge sales successes. Not like over at Marvel where he kind of, you know, he was editor-in-chief. He was Stan's right-hand man. Marv Wolfman.
For me, yeah, because he went over and did Teen Titans. And that was, I mean, people forget, that sold X-Men level when it was out.
I think Wolfman belonged at DC. You know, he had some good stuff at Marvel, but his run on Spider-Man was, it was okay. His run on Fantastic Four, yeah, it was okay. You look at his DC stuff, Crisis on Infinite Earths, New Teen Titans, revamping Superman, on and on and on and on and on. John Byrne.
I would say yes, because that was a media event. When he jumped over to do Superman, sales-wise, it had to have been crazy because, geez, I mean, I think to this day, Pat still has that miniseries, Man of Steel, in his basement somewhere because he bought, he had to have bought hundreds of those things.
I'm John Byrne, hot artist.
Eventually, he kind of faded out, but he made Superman definitely more relevant and more of a character. And I still think that plays today, where people don't look at Superman as the big-ass Boy Scout anymore. I mean, he basically took a book, and I think I even talked about this in past podcasts. You know, I felt guilty because, yeah, I should be reading Superman. He's the one who started it all, but they were just lame. You know, every so often there'd be a really cool run, and then it would go back to a meh storyline. And Byrne took it and made it a must-read.
I'm trying to think of anybody who jumped from DC to Marvel that was a huge success. And I'm having trouble thinking of anybody. It doesn't seem to work the other way.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll think of it after the podcast. It's like, oh, we should have thought of this. So, and of
you
course,
could,
if our listeners
you could say
anybody,
Kurt Busiek, but Busiek didn't do a whole lot at DC before he came to Marvel.
Yeah. And you can also, you know, again, if one of our listeners thinks of something, give us a drop us a line, and you know, we'll talk. We could pick up this thread in a future podcast. You know, we will as the books start coming out.
Yeah. And that's the thing. When Bendis does his first DC book, it's going to be the number one selling book that month. Because there's going to be this curiosity of, okay, what's he going to do? So there have been some where it's been a huge success and some where they just, I don't think Kirby ever worked in the DC corporate style. As much as Roy Thomas loved the DC characters, I don't think it ever really worked at the DC character style. He played with the Golden Age stuff, but any of the stuff he did in the Modern Age just didn't work. I can't think of anything he did. And some of his big stories, like Last Days of the Justice League, no, Last Days of the Justice League was just bad. Just bad.
Justice League or Society?
Oh, I'm sorry. Last Days of the Justice Society.
Yeah, I'm going through my brain. I don't think I read that one.
It's the one where we find out that the America versus the Justice Society was really good because it did what Roy could do, which is take a whole bunch of weird history and turn it into a story.
Oh, you're talking the one where they got stuck in a little tiny globe that showed up in Sandman later.
Yes, the one where they're fighting Ragnarok over and over and over and over and over and over. And Roy said, you know, he didn't have a lot of time to do it, and he was told, just get rid of the Justice Society. Just get rid of them.
Yeah, we've had enough. They're getting a little arrogant. They're asking for a raise. I don't care. get them out of here.
Now, the other story that hit that doesn't have as much to do with comics, but has more to do with the movies and everything else. Disney is in talks to buy Fox. Everything except the news and the sports.
They stopped talking.
No, it's back on.
There's nothing like a little media spotlight to get talks off.
No, Forbes announced that the talks are back on.
Good man, that Forbes.
So there are a lot of people going on and on about how, oh, this will mean the Fantastic Four and the X-Men will be back. I'm a little more, wow, that means Disney would own ABC and Fox Broadcast Networks. And look at all the cable networks they would own.
I've always said I just signed, 90% of my paycheck over to Disney.
Because I have heard that Disney's trying to sell ABC. And I find that a little weird because they really have, I think Disney has used ABC really well to leverage their other properties. And, you got the whole vertical integration because Disney creates TV series. Well, if they run them on ABC, that means ABC has a vested interest in keeping them on the air because then, 100 episodes, we could syndicate this, and that's more money for us. So, but I think the consolidation of media would be not good, personally, because say what you want, Disney has a certain look and a style from their kid stuff to their adult stuff. And you get rid of more and more of that diversity of style. Well, if you don't like that style, that's more and more chances you have to stay home and not go to the movies and not watch TV on their channels. But I would like to see the X-Men and the Fantastic Four back in the Marvel cinematic universe.
It's a small world after all. I'm sorry, what?
Well, you know who's not going to be consolidating and causing problems anytime soon?
Our sponsors, these guys!
That's right, here at the Solitaire Rose Radio Network, we have ads, and our first sponsor is me. That's right, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. I have my first book out with Dangerous Dan Moore. It's the first 100 strips of our online web strip, Worldwide News, the story of the lowest-rated cable news network. And you can get yourself a copy with commentary, with all sorts of extras, with signatures and everything. Just email Dan over at lordshadowflame@gmail.com. Our top sponsor, who's been with us since day one, is DreamHost. DreamHost.com. You need yourself a website, and DreamHost.com is the number one web host in the whole known universe. Just head over to DreamHost.com, put in the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, get $20 off your first year. How can you beat that? Our other sponsor is Graze, G-R-A-Z-E.com. Healthy snacks for a healthy lifestyle. Just head over to Graze, put in the code CORYS3R5P. Your first and fifth box are free. You can get them weekly. You can get them bi-weekly. You can get them monthly. You just order a whole bunch of them. It's great stuff to keep you away from the vending machine at work. Now, if you would like to leave a comment for any of the podcasts that we do, we'd love those. Go ahead and email us at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com, or you can call 952-856-0519. Operators are standing by. Okay, it's just a place that we'll record your calls, but we'll play them on the air. We'll answer your questions. We love getting feedback. Tell us what you think. Ask a question. Suggest a topic. Be a guest. Send us your stuff. SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com. If you would like to advertise on any of the Solitaire Rose radio shows, you can. Just email us at SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com. Subject advertising. Thanks. And after we do the sponsors, I'm going to talk a little about the Solitaire Rose Network, Joe.
Well, good, because Lord knows if there's one thing you like better than comics, pie, redheads, brunettes, Omnibus, hanging at the home. It's, I'm sorry, what were you going to talk about?
I'm going to talk about the Solitaire Rose Network. Later on today, Dan Moore and I are going to be recording some episodes of Bad Advice. So Wolfie's going to be sexually harassing me, and we're going to answer your questions and giving you bad advice. Novelcast is coming up. New episodes of Solitaire Rose Radio are coming up. And Dave and Stephanie Cafell are still doing their thing over at Scrabbling Across the West. And maybe one of these days, Joe will do a solo podcast. Maybe. Possibly.
As soon as I find a microphone that works with my damn computer.
Ah, there you go. And after we talk about what's coming up on the podcast, on the network, I run to the bathroom and Joe talks about what's going on the eBays.
And lots of things going on in the eBay because, as you know, once I got rid of my vast accumulation of crap, at least 19 boxes of it, now I'm going through the good stuff and some of the things that have sold. Actually, I was hoping Corey would be here. We'll wait till he comes back and I'll ask him this one. Sex Criminals number one. My daughter gave me her run of Sex Criminals and decided she didn't want it. Sex Criminals, of course, is from Image. Off our friends at AtomicAvenue.com. Susie's just a regular gal with an irregular gift. When she has sex, she stops time. One day she meets John. Turns out he has the same ability. Sooner or later, they get around to their using their gifts to do what we'd all do, rob a couple banks. I'd personally probably rob a few comic shows, but that's a different subject. So Matt Fraction, Chip, I don't know, something with a Z, Zardarsky, Sky, I might have had that right. He can call me, tell me if I got it right or wrong. So first issue gone. You had a chance. The other ones are up there if you want them. Every so often, I have a comic book that I have to stop and think, do I really want to sell it? Because this one was Darker Image number one. The gold logo variant cover from 1983 has the first appearance of Max, of Deathblow. And the reason why I was hesitant to sell it was because I actually earned this one. This one was back when Cap City had their shows, and they were the retailer. It was like, well, I think the first Cap City show that Pat and I went to owning Hot Comics. And, of course, the guys from West went, and we went. And at the end of the retailer summit, Image had a dance. And one of the things they did is while you were dancing, if you did something or they caught their attention, they would give you a copy of Darker Image Gold. And obviously, since I have one, I did something good. But I know out of the four guys that were with us, three of us got one just by dancing. And, you know, guys would do weird things. And, you know, the Image guys up there that had the books, they were lording over like they were, you know, giving Oliver Twist gruel. And so eventually I danced well enough and I got myself a copy, a Darker Image. And then, you know, we wanted to get going and Dan Wiesemeyer was dancing. And to this day, I wish I could remember who we were dancing with. The poor girl who danced with all three of us. And I hope she got a Darker Image gold eventually, but we were just waiting and we were trying to get the guy's attention to give Dan one. And finally, I think we just ran, picked up Dan Wiesemeyer, walked around the room with him on his shoulders, and then the guy looked at us, tossed a Darker Image to us. Pat didn't want to dance with the girl, so we all took off. Three of us got the Darker Image, number one gold, and, you know, occasionally I have comics like that that have a story behind it, and I'm kind of like, I don't know if I want to sell it, but I'll always have the memories, and if I want, I can go buy another Darker Image gold. This one was bagged and everything, and now I did hear Corey snuffle his way back. Corey, it's time to Ask the Strode.
Now, here's the thing. We have a new part of Ask the Strode, and does Joe know? If one of us gets the answer right, the other has to give them a shiny new dime.
Yes. Well, this isn't I suppose that can work. Okay, hang on. Let's see. Okay, I got my dime here. Oops. Damn, I dropped it. Oh, well, I'll find it later. Corey, what is BN Puppy Cat?
BN Puppy Cat? I have no idea in the world.
Of course you would, because this is a Adventure Time cartoon based on, it's from a lady, Natasha Elgri, who worked on Adventure Time, and she made a gender-swapped characters, Fiona and Cake, and then she created, that was on Adventure Time, and then she created Bee and Puppy Cat, and it became the most funded web series project in Kickstarter history. And Boom Studio published an issue. My daughter was vaguely interested in it. I picked her up a first copy and never picked up another one. Now, do you remember what I told you? You remember the story of SpongeBob SquarePants comic and how much
yes.
toys it were? This has a similar value to it. I sold mine on eBay for the princely sum of $20. And they're
$20?
And that was going low, remember, because my thing on eBay is to price it low enough to actually sell it. If you look on the guides, they say they're just cover price. Don't you believe it. It's just one of those books that, again, I don't watch Adventure Time cartoons. I had no idea who Natasha was. When my daughter gave me her comics to sell, this is when I looked up and I go, wow. And I ended up selling it for her. You had your chance. You missed it. Other things that sold recently, a run of Unbeatable Squirrel Girl 1-6. I have a bunch of autographs up from the MCBA's charity booth, so if you want to take a look at those. The first one sold was Alyssa Milano, and the ones I put up actually have a certificate of authenticity. Archie and Friends, number 47, which came out about the time Josie and the Pussycat movie did, and actually have, it has the, I think, Dan DiCarlo drew it, and the movie poster of the girls right next to it. So all sorts of fun stuff. I've been loading stuff on eBay's really fast and furious. So if you get a chance, check it out. I'll probably have another 100 online tomorrow. And if you ever see anything you like, just let me know. Make a best offer. Let me know you listen to this here podcast. I'll do something nice. Maybe I'll give you the prized copies of Worldwide News that I have in my greedy little hands.
Maybe you'll clean their apartment.
No, that's your shtick.
Damn it.
I'm the messier. I'm not the cleaner. So I've always got some stuff to give away. Crazy. K-R-A-Y-Z. Come get some.
I have an answer to a question we asked a couple episodes ago, Joe.
Oh, good.
Remember when we were talking about Spider-Man and how we thought it was a little weird that Roy Thomas never had a run of Spider-Man?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that happened, Roy was supposed to take over Spider-Man with issue 101, and he did write the conclusion of the Spider-Man with four extra arms story and introduce Morbius the Living Vampire. But Stan stepped back in and took over the writing on Spider-Man again, and by the time he stepped away, Roy was very busy being editor-in-chief, which is why Spider-Man went to Gary Conway. But Roy recently said he doesn't have a Facebook page, but there is a Roy Thomas appreciation page where if you ask a question, one of the people on that page will email Roy to ask him.
Oh, wow.
And Roy said that Spider-Man was never a character he had a lot of interest in, and when he wrote the character after issue 100, he realized that he really didn't have a lot of affinity for the character and didn't think he'd be a good writer on the book, so he never had a run on Spider-Man. He did a few issues of Marvel Team-Up, but on those, he said it was mostly to write the character who was teaming up with Spider-Man. So there we go. We got an answer from the boy himself, Roy the Boy Thomas, who's now almost 70.
Still a boy.
Yep. Well, because that's what Stan called him.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we've answered a question, and Joe has told us on the eBay, it's my favorite part of the show. No, not where I stuff my face full of Tim Horton Timbits and let Joe run the thing. It's freaking a geeking. Joe, what are you freaking on?
Well, let's see, other than being sick, that's pretty much it. I don't really have a lot of freakings going on. Things have actually been going pretty good. How about you, Corey? What are you freaking on?
Well, we are in the middle of open enrollment. And for those of you who don't know benefits, every year your employer is supposed to allow you to change your benefits. Now, the group home that I work at now, before they were bought by the bigger group home company, they did not have open enrollment. And they were getting in a lot of trouble because it was found out that they didn't have open enrollment. And when they got sold, the case got dropped. But they were being investigated for that. I have no idea who turned them in. None. No idea at all. But for open enrollment, for however long the employer says, usually 3 weeks, everybody in the company can change their benefits for the upcoming benefit year.
We have ours coming up actually this week in government, which I suppose is a mini freaking for me, because much as I'd like to take it over, so, you know, with Chris's impending job loss, I mean, she's really losing her job, but she's losing working with the mayor, who's, you know, not running. He's not mayor anymore, so he's running now for governor. But her job's in kind of a flux. And I was like, well, I will take over the benefits. But her benefits get in place like in October, and I don't get mine until November, so we can never coordinate who could get a better deal.
By the way, just so you know, Joe, if one or the other of you were to end the benefits, that is a qualified life event, and you're able, the other can change their benefits at that time.
So maybe she could drop hers. I don't know. Yeah. We'll figure it out. Like I said, mine actually start tomorrow, and that's when I'll start getting all the information.
But it means people can change their benefits. And I was on two clients. I am now on three clients, all of which are going through open enrollment pretty much simultaneously. So I have been working 12-hour days at the full-time job, answering calls, and I'm really, really tired. Not even sleeping at the group home. I only had one overnight shift at the group home this week because I knew that the open enrollment would just drain me. And I don't mind talking to people about their benefits. I enjoy those calls. I don't mind telling people, you know, when they say, you know, tell me about this, I will go into detail. I actually enjoy that. The calls that hurt and are painful and make me want to crawl under the desk and never come out, I don't know how to reset my password on the benefit page.
Can you read?
There is nothing more painful than helping someone who doesn't know about computers try to follow instructions on a computer to set a password. I had one call where 5 minutes in, and I'd been talking to this person and giving them direction and telling them what to do for 5 minutes, and they kept saying, don't work, till I realized they had yet to open their browser, and they were doing all of it in a Word file. I can enroll you in your benefits if you've got 7 kids and a domestic partner and don't know anything about what a deductible is. I could do that in 15 minutes. Helping somebody who doesn't know computers reset their password, 25 minutes. And the whole time I'm at my desk, just my head on the desk itself, wanting to die. And if my calls weren't being recorded, some of them I would say, okay, do you have grandkids? Have them do it for you. Because you don't know anything about computers and shouldn't be allowed to touch them, okay? You've got grandkids, they'll know how to do this pretty easy. Comic-wise, because of that, I haven't had time to read much of anything. So, Box Day was last week. I still haven't unwrapped everything. I still have the box with all the packing peanuts that I need to double-check and make sure I got everything out of. So, I'm freaking that I haven't had much time to read stuff. And yeah, that's my freaking. This is our busy time of year. This is when everything goes nuts, and I'm feeling the pain. Joe, what are you geeking on?
Stranger Things.
Oh, I hear that's really good.
My wife and I binged the first season. We were maybe a third of the way into the third season, and we're kind of like, you know what, we're going to either finish it up this Tuesday or we're going to go do a $5 movie and go see the LBJ movie that Woody Harrelson is in. Really fun, a lot of fun. It's kind of interesting the way things kind of weave around. And, you know, if Netflix keeps it up, I suppose the loss of all the Marvel films to Disney streaming, well, it won't make that big a difference because they're actually doing pretty good. I did see the Thor movie. I went alone. Kruger had seen it twice, didn't want to go. Corey didn't want to go. Something about, I need to sleep, you wuss.
I was in bed when you called.
Couldn't find Butch. It was a free ticket. Fortunately, the theater was nice enough to refund the unused ticket, which was kind of cool. I enjoyed it. I won't talk much about it until you folks get a chance to see it, or at very least Corey does. It'll probably be like Spider-Man. We'll have to wait until Corey gets it on DVD. But I enjoyed it. It wasn't the, oh, my God, wow movie. And I don't know if a Marvel movie will ever do that to me again because, you know, Spider-Man, Avengers, Iron Man, you know, they had the wow factor being the first time you've seen them all together, and it was just amazing. And now it's kind of, yeah, let's get together. It'll be fun watching it, but not as big a wow. I did what I call a half-price book run about a week or so ago where I hit almost every half-price book in the Twin Cities, and I think there's five or six of them. Didn't see much. And, you know, there's things I'm not – it's either I got to have it, got to buy it, and then there's also things like, you know, I've already got like 500 books that I – read. Do I need another 500? I did buy two things, though. I did find, and Corey probably remembers, you remember the movie Dark Star?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a, I found the Alan Dean Foster, a Del Rey.
The adaptation.
Yeah. So, Dark Star, of course, is a movie that, Dan O'Bannon? Did it? It was his like high school or no college project, and then they padded it up to make it a full length feature.
And John Carpenter, I do believe. I'm going to look that
yes.
up, but I believe it's John Carpenter.
And I enjoyed the heck out of it.
Yep, John Carpenter's first film.
If you can get a piece of get to see it, check it out. I picked this up for a couple bucks. I also picked up a classic album collection of the Monkees for like $25. It's a CD of every single one they did. From Monkees all the way to Changes, which was the last album done that only had Mickey and Davey on it. And then they include a bonus disc with cuts like that. I have these in record album. I mean, I went through and Rhino had these in reprints. I picked up some of the originals at garage sales in the 70s. But now I have them all on CD, so I could probably done blow them out. I applied for a new job TSA-wise. So
what?
We'll see if that happens. I don't think it will because my theory is that whenever there's an application of something open at TSA, they have somebody in mind that they want, but they have to go through the process of, you know, we had a fair and transparent and open policy, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I brushed up my resume. Chris helped me, and I applied for it. So we'll see if we get it. I did get in the mail a book from Steve Rude.
The Rude dude.
They were doing a Kickstarter, and it got waylaid because of a personal tragedy. And what they had done is said, hey, you know, we're just going to fill this with extra stock. And hang on a second, because dummy me left it on the piano, which unfortunately is about 20 feet away from where I am. A copy of the Nexus Chronicle, which is a really big, heavy hardcover book. And I didn't get the autographed. I probably should have. If I'd have known it had been this long to get, I probably would have had him autograph it. So that was kind of cool. I mean, it's not what they were soliciting for, but it's nice that they did come through and actually, you know, admit, hey, you know, something happened. I think I don't know what I did. I think it was like out of the money I paid, some of this went towards it, and then the rest I said just keep for whatever expenses you have because of the tragedy there. You didn't hear about Freaking with Pat Broderick on the artwork because I did actually get a hold of him finally. He told me apparently his wife's been monitoring his Facebook, which is why I never got a response, but he said he is working on it, trying to get to it. Like I expected, he's doing conventions almost every weekend, so it's hard to get a hold of him. But we are in contact, so he's out of the Freaking column, into the Geeking column. So, since Corey didn't do a lot of reading, I'm gonna spend a couple minutes here and talk about the things I have read, because I've actually read quite a bit. I finished the three Marvel graphic novels, Strike Force, Morituri. Really good run. The ending kind of smacks of let's give everybody a sappy, happy ending. They left it open at the end of the original series and then did the, what was that, that five-issue epic run?
Yeah.
Electric?
It was Prestige format, but I don't remember what it was called.
Yeah, and that's included in there. And it was an interesting run. It got to the end, and if you can find it cheap, it's definitely worth picking up. Once upon a time, I picked up a run of JLA, the Grant Morrison runs, from our podcasting brother, Adam Vermillion. I read through it, and I got to say, it was fun. There's a couple of Mark Waid issues in there because he was also grooming. And I think I'm going to probably continue this run just because, like I said, Mark Waid took over and did a really good job with it. Still got a problem with the whole, what did they call that stupid-ass thing that was coming to Earth? Mageddon?
Mageddon. I mean, like,
what did they do with it? It was a huge war machine, and it dwarfed the Earth the way, like one of the gaseous giants did. And at the end of it, they were just like, oh, we defeated it. Everything's okay. Well, where did it go? You know, they never really addressed it, which was weird. I read the season 3 to date of Kaiju Max from Xander Canning. I'm telling you, Xander Cannon, that is, if you haven't read this, if you like giant monsters or how do you say them? Kaiju. You really owe it to yourself to either pick up the issues or pick up the graphic novels that'll come out, because he has done a wonderful job. The gist is that, you know, these giant monsters that roam and beat up the Earth, they get captured and put on a jail island. Let's see. Other things I read, I got caught up on Thanos through issue 12. A really fun run. And I don't know if they're continuing it. I know the series goes on, but I enjoyed the run. I think Lemire Patalata, I don't know. I'm terrible with names. You go look it up. Reread Swamp Thing 4950. This is the end of the American Saga. I just read it because I have the books that are going to go on eBay, and I didn't want to get rid of them until then. Of the legacy books, I caught up with Iron Man. Like I said, we talked about Bendis, and I'll ride this out to the end just because now they are finally getting around the search for Tony Stark. I picked up Amazing Spider-Man, Fall of Parker, which is really kind of interesting. They're doing a good job of explaining how Parker industry is falling. But I do have – the only real problem I have with this whole thing is Shields, and of course, they're gone now anyways – but, and I remember I had to text Corey, because as I'm reading this, I'm like, they're referring to the fact that S.H.I.E.L.D. is gone. And I'm like, what happened to S.H.I.E.L.D.? They got disbanded because of what happened in Secret Empire, which I haven't read. So, but I had a big problem with Nick Fury's attitude of, you know, when he found out Norm Osborn was running a country and running weapons. Well, we just don't attack countries that do that. Dude. Norm Osborn is like public enemy number one. That would be like if Hitler reestablished himself in a country and there wasn't anybody in the world that was going to attack him. This is what leads to the fall of Parker, because S.H.I.E.L.D. totally denounces him and makes him enemy number one. And I'm like, that really stretches credibility story-wise, because Norm is, I mean, anywhere, Norm is such an evil person for what he did in Avenger runs and Dark Avengers and with Hammer and Sword and the Fall of Asgard. There is no way he could show his face anywhere. And if anybody, you know, I just find it hard to believe that S.H.I.E.L.D. would be like, well, we're not going to attack him, even though he's sending out evil things that could, you know, destroy, take over the world, and yet we're going to blame Parker for attacking him. You know, a better excuse would have been, we had plans to take him down and you ruined it. You know, and if this is the consequence. But other than that little brain fart blip, the story's been really good. I did read the first issue of Tick that our Doug Peskovich. He knows his name. He did the art. I don't know how involved in the story he is. Unfortunately, it's his only issue, so I guess that's off my list. I did read...
Now, my question is, his humor is very brutal. And the Tick was always kind of very gentle, silly humor. Does his work fit the Tick?
I thought it did. You know, and it was kind of, because there's things going on where guys are dying, and Tick's pretty oblivious of what's going on, because basically it's killer clowns and ninjas have gotten together, and Tick, as you read through it, Tick's kind of having a existential moment where he's not quite sure if what he's doing is right or not. All he knows is he needs to get to Canada, and it does tie into other things previous. And as Tick's going through and Arthur's, you know, worried about it, he's pretty oblivious to what's going on, other than when he sees a ninja, he needs to fight it. Or he sees a killer clown, he needs to fight it. But like we said, it's only the first issue, it's the last issue. As I said before, I did read the latest Avengers by Brian Michael Bendis, Complete Collection number 2. This one covers, let's see, the 2010 run of Avengers, 12.1, which is kind of a leader up to Age of Ultron, and issues 13 to 24, and it also puts together Avengers Assemble, an oral history of Earth's mightiest heroes, which was extremely hard to read in the comic book because it went through all the different Avenger comics, but when you get it down and you read it as a book, and this is basically, you know, this is a good third of the book, it actually is a lot of fun to read. There are a couple times you got to scratch your head where you'd be like, yeah, I don't know if Avenger would reveal that publicly. And there's even a few other times when they kind of talk about, well, you know, Scarlet Witch doesn't want you talking about that, but we, you know, especially when they talk about her falling in love with Vision. But it was a fun read, finally getting it all together as one. The only negative I had was, I can't have anything nice. Part of my... I set something wet down by this because I was reading through the book and I suddenly realized, you know how when you've seen something that's been wet and it dried out and you get the kind of crinkly thing? And I found that on top of the book and I was like, dang, I can't believe it got sent to me that way. And then I was going to call in and say I got a damaged book. And then I saw the bookmark that I stuck in. It was that way. So it must have been something I did. I can't have nothing nice. The other... last thing that I read, we got a bunch of Halloween Comic Fest in this edition of our Box Day thing, and I actually read through them all, and I kind of have them ranked in terms of which ones I enjoyed down to the ones that didn't work. The first one I got is Lady Mechanica. It's from Benitez Productions, and it was enjoyable. I like the character. She's suffering a loss, so she kind of is away from her normal haunts, trying to recover from it. There's a good summary of the graphic novels you can buy that will cover it up. It's everything a sampler book should be, and it's one I might have to go hunt out because the art was good. Story was pretty fun. One I definitely am going to try to find is something from Action Lab called Black Betty. She's a monster fighter. We don't know a lot about her, but all we know is she can kick ass and fight monsters. And the worst she can do is when her big thing is if a monster really gets out of line, she can absorb it into herself and it appears as a tattoo on her body. There's also a few other ads here for, what was the one there? Danger Doll Squad, which didn't quite... actually, that one kind of caught my attention, too. Again, this is what you should be doing with your books. In case of Danger Girl Squad, they're basically taking three of their properties. Zombie Tramp, who I'm familiar with. Vamp Blade. And there's a third one there. And they put them all together kind of in a team-up type book. So that one didn't really strike me as much, but Black Betty I'm definitely going to go look for. Read the first issue of Runaways. This is an older one from Marvel. Never read this series. I'm definitely going to have to seek it out after reading this particular thing. And, of course, the gist of the story is these are basically kids of supervillains. And they find out at the end of the particular book, and this one leaves off on a cliffhanger. And, of course... also, to be continued. And of course, you got to go out and find the Runaways. But there's plenty of reprints in that. Might even be on Marvel Unlimited. The last three I'll cover. I read Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, which I don't think this ties into the afterlife with Archie, does it? It's just its own.
Yes, it is its own.
And it's a pretty good read. I mean, probably what Sabrina would be if she wasn't such a happy teenage witch. From Young 3K Studio, if I'm saying it right, Alika Dragon Trials. And, again, another book I had no inkling of, not even on the radar, but just reading through the first issue, there was enough of an interest in it where I may have to go finally look for the graphic novel. And the last one I'm going to go through, and there was actually a lot of good ones here. I mean, they had one from Viz Media called Shiver, which was really creepy. Grim Tales of Terror, which was from Zenscope, which wasn't as creepy, but still kind of, you know, made you just shiver. The last one was from Aftershock called Baby Teeth. And it's just it's a black and white type thing, and as I'm reading through it, I definitely may have to pick this one up when it comes out in graphic novels. So, again, these are supposed to do. These aren't free to comic shops, so if you were able to get to a comic shop and pick up these issues, they've whetted my appetite for more. And just in case you're wondering, the last one on the list that I really didn't care much for was DC Superhero Girls from obviously DC, and then Aspen had a Choose Your Own Aspen Adventure. These are actually more aimed towards kids, and you know, if you've got a young girl, definitely the DC Superhero Girls you want to give to her. But the you know, again, I read through them and I was like, you know, these aren't aimed at me, so I don't hold that against them. So. Whole lot of geeking going on. Corey, what you geeking on?
Joe, do you have the Thor Digest that Archie put out?
It's in my to-be-read list.
Do you have it near you?
No.
When you're done, I want you to go pick that up, the first story. What is the Thor story that I have talked about more than any other Thor story in history?
Mangog.
They've got the entire four-issue Mangog story right there.
You haven't read the current Legacy Thor, have you?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so you I mean, it's spoiler, but you saw who showed up in the last
issue. Yes.
I mean, that's almost enough to get me to buy the run, if not maybe wait till the graphic novel.
Second thing in that digest,
Mangog.
The Korvac story.
Mangog. Sorry, I just like saying that. Mangog.
The,
why don't you and your Mangog just go home? I can say I'm going to say that at somebody at work today and get in trouble.
My Mangog and my giant-sized man thing.
They're here for your amusement.
But there's also the first Korvac story, which was Thor Annual number 6, where Thor teamed up with the Guardians of the Galaxy.
The originals, not the posers.
Yeah. So then the rest is the Marvel Adventures Thor story. So I like the fact that they're repurposing those. Because, you know, they were made for kids. The line lasted a long time, so there's a lot of material that they can use that a lot of people just haven't seen. But
sometimes it's fun to read when they don't have, like, 500 years of continuity clogging.
Yes. But the Mangog story, god damn, that's good. God damn, that's good. And Kirby's art, I would much rather it be bigger, because the first time I read it, it was a treasury.
Wow.
Yeah. Corey, what made you a Kirby fan? Treasuries. But it's nice that that story, you know, now I've got it as the treasury and the essential and the omnibus and now in a little digest. And, of course, you know, a Marvel Unlimited. So excited about that. Comet TV, which is one of these digital networks. It's owned by Sinclair Broadcasting, the same people who give us Ring of Honor. They own Ring of Honor and a whole bunch of really scary right-wing crap. Comet TV, most of it is, you know, sci-fi that's public domain or real dirt cheap or whatever. But on Sunday nights, they run two classic episodes of Mystery Science Theater back to back. So when I've been getting home from these 12-hour days, I am getting into bed and watching a classic Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode to kind of keep my brain from exploding. That is how I have gotten through the week. Open enrollment lasts until Thanksgiving for the three clients I'm on.
Lucky guy.
The other thing I am geeking on, other than a sleeping overnight, I am off all of Thanksgiving.
Cool.
Thanksgiving off. I have the day after Thanksgiving off. I have the Saturday after Thanksgiving off. And I have the Sunday after Thanksgiving off.
Well, which day do you want to geek on?
It doesn't matter to me. Whatever day works best for you, because that's also the last weekend that Minnesota's largest candy store is open. Now, I have a new tradition, and that tradition is that I do go to the Minnesota's largest candy store first thing in the morning on Thanksgiving, not just to pick up a pie, but because that's their last weekend. And the reason that started, when I was doing overnights, they would ask me to get the Thanksgiving dinner started. And this year they are asking me to brine the turkey and get that ready, but not bake the entire meal, because they're going to have it late. Normally they have it at noon. This year they're having it in the evening, because they've learned that if they have it at noon, the clients will eat a whole lot and then sleep all day long and then stay up at night. They don't want that. So, I don't know why.
Not a good idea.
But I still will be waking up early on Thanksgiving, buzzing out and picking up at least one pie and maybe two. And what was the pastry thing that we bought last year?
I don't remember.
It's some German pastry thing. And then when I get home, they're having a Mystery Science Theater 3000 Turkey Day Marathon, and it's running on YouTube and Shout TV and Pluto TV and all of your streaming devices. So excited about that, but also very excited because I don't have anything planned that Thanksgiving weekend. And I've got all kinds of comics for this month that I have not had time to read. So basically that weekend's going to be, when I just get home, I just throw stuff down and go to bed. So I probably need to kind of pick things up. But yeah, a 4-day weekend. Scary. Scary.
Absolutely.
And the overnight is just from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. They tried to get me to work later on that Friday. You know, can you stay till? And I just said no. I lied and said that I do have to work that day.
Hopefully they're not listening to the podcast.
Nobody at the group home listens.
Yeah, nobody at TSA listens here either, so we're pretty good.
And then the fourth Master of Kung Fu omnibus came in. Now, for omnibuses, I tend to go and prefer to go with, they usually have two covers, and I prefer the classic cover. And if you buy them, the cover by the modern artist is always inside. But with number four, when I saw the cover, I had to buy the new cover. David Mack did the cover for volume four. And it's beautiful. It is a beautiful piece of art. And I did inquire with David Mack. Joe, you know I don't buy a lot of original art. Matter of fact, when I clean the comic room, I'm going to be giving you a whole bunch of original art to sell.
Art.
But I did inquire as to how much the cover was, and it was pretty far outside my budget.
Oh, yeah.
But
we're amateurs.
Oh, it's beautiful. Just beautiful. And one of the things I'm also seeing original art-wise is Bill Sienkiewicz is, he often asks, well, why isn't this artist doing comics anymore? I ask, why isn't Bill Sienkiewicz doing comics anymore? He will do a quick sketch, put it up on Facebook, and it will sell for a couple $100. So why does he need to do comics if he can sit down, do a sketch, it takes 15, 20 minutes, and make more money than I make in 2 days? I don't think he ever needs to do another comic again.
Nope.
So, well, that and the money he gets from the New Mutants and Legion. So, But become friends with Bill Sienkiewicz on the Facebook so you can see his art. And really, that's all I'm geeking on. I have not had time to do a whole lot. Yesterday, I'm doing more social things. Thursday night, I went out with Sharon, and we got Tim Hortons because it's I had most of this weekend off, so I need me my donuts. And then last night, I went over to my friend's Tommy's house, and we watched bad movies, one of which was way too competent for us to watch. But it had Barbara Steele in it, and I'll watch anything with Barbara Steele in it. And I was reading up. It's called The She-Beast. And it's about a witch who was killed 200 years ago, and it's a 200th anniversary, and now she's coming back to take vengeance. But Barbara Steele is listed as the star. She is in, like, the first, I would say, like, 10 minutes of the movie and the last 3-4 minutes of the movie. She was paid $1,000 for one day of filming. They brought her in, did her one day of filming, sent her home. You don't hear a lot about that. Here's the star of this movie. They worked on it for a single day. And boy, it showed. But, you know, it's Barbara Steele. Anyway. So that's what I'm geeking on. That's about it, really. Believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about comic books real early Sunday morning for almost an hour and a half.
Isn't that better than going to church?
And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most, Joe.
Quick, ask the Strode.
Oh, no.
What is Brian Bendis' first comic book?
Ooh.
Come from Caliber.
Yeah, I know. He started at Caliber, and he was doing his own art.
1993. Two issues. Noir fiction crime.
Yeah.
Starts with the letter F.
It's not the one I'm thinking of. I thought it was either AKA Goldfish or...
'94.
Or Jinx.
Nope. Jinx was 96. His first one was Fire. Two issues.
Oh, and then it was reprinted called Codename Fire.
Yep.
And it had that terrible photo cover on the trade paperback. Oh, that cover was just...
No, that
it was bad.
That was actually the regular comics. It was like two... whoever the woman was photo cover. And then the books, the first Fire was just a red, and then, like you said, they renamed it Codename Fire. But Images did a definitive collection, and you can find any of them. They're fairly cheap. No worries.
Okay. Does Joe know?
Dun, dun, dun.
For a shiny new dime. Brian Michael Bendis has talked about the first comic he ever drew when he was in junior high. What was it?
Spunky Todd.
Nope.
Oh.
He did an adaptation of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he said that the opening sequence took like 60 or 70 pages. Which, if you know Bendis, should not surprise you at all.
Well, I guess no dimes for us.
No, no dimes this week.
For you, hit my music. Funk is on a roll.
Done, bitches!